This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This is being recorded on July 21st, 2009. Tonight, we are going to talk to Nate Kahari. Nate, you may know in the past from the Ninject IOC framework, is the author of that, and has a new project management website slash service called Agile Zen. And so we're going to talk to him tonight about that. So thanks for coming on, Nate.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you give us a little bit of the sort of overview of what Zen is about and the sort of lean Kanban sort of a philosophy of project management?
Sure. I was actually first exposed to lean and Kanban. It's been about a year or so. And really, it's all just about eliminating waste in your process and trying to find different areas where you're wasting effort and wasting time and try to get rid of those. And so what happens is through Kanban is you can actually organize your task pipeline into like a series of phases. And what Zen lets you do is creates this board that you can hang these work items on and move them across the board as they reach completion. Of course, that's not an idea that we came up with or anything like that. It's, a lot of teams have been doing it with sticky notes or, index cards and push pins and, that sort of thing, the office supply kind of porn. So what we've done is kind of taken that and put it on, the web. So if you have a distributed team or, something like that, it makes it much easier to work together. So, but again, lean at root is really all about, finding and reducing waste, orienting your process towards a pull system rather than a push system, and continually, finding ways that you can improve the way that you work. A lot of introspection and finding things that you can do better. So that's the whole concept of Kaizen, which is, continuous improvement.
We and a lot of our listeners probably heard you on Hansel Bennett's recently, and you guys talked a lot about Kanban and Zen's approach to it. We don't want to just rehash all that same stuff. And I don't want to make you guys, give the same spiel over and over again. So I was hoping we could get a little bit more into the sort of the technical aspects of it, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's start with just where did the idea come from? Like, was it just you, had a brainstorm one day and started building this thing?
It was actually me complaining for a long time. A lot of products come from, feeling the pain yourself. And that was really how it went for me. I'd used other, project management tools previously, and they were just always, too complex or, too expensive. It seems like they were all aiming for like the high end of the market, the large enterprise-y kind of deployments. And my experience has been largely in small teams. And so, it was all a lot of overkill for, what we needed. And so, I complained about it for a long time, and I got needled to write it myself by James Avery and Mike Eaton. Actually, I would always complain to them, and they'd say, yeah, it'd be nice if we had a tool like that. Why don't you go write it? So what happened was, around the same time, I was, being exposed to lean software development. And I was talking it over with my wife, actually, who's a industrial organizational psychologist. She's finishing up her PhD. And started talking about the Toyota production system and, the background there. And she was like, oh, yeah, I know all about that, that she'd done, research on it and or, studied, that sort of thing. Because her background is in IO psychology is all about like efficiency consulting and organizational development and, that sort of stuff. So kind of, the soft skills sort of end of things. And so anyways, and I'm sure I'm not describing that very well because honestly, I don't understand the first bit of it. But we found that there was an interesting kind of overlap in our skill sets. So like, me coming from the software side and her coming from an organizational development side, this, process control system sort of stuff was, if you think of a Venn diagram, we were right there in the middle. So there were some more conversations and we realized we could probably turn it into a product, and that's where Zen came from pretty much.
And so was it just you building the product by yourself?
Yep. I'm actually the only software developer. So, you know, she right now that we're launched, she's handling the more operational side of the business. So, you know, the day-to-day kind of stuff. But yeah, it's only been me. So
what was your design process? Because it's very obvious that, you know, the user experience is way in front. The way I get the same kind of feel, different design, but same kind of feeling as like Stack Overflow, and that it kind of, you know, it's that kind of experience first sort of design. What do you do a lot of like sketching, or, you know what I mean? What's your kind of process for designing the user experience?
I usually do, you know, a lot of whiteboarding, kind of wireframe stuff, and then mock it up, you know, do comps in Photoshop and stuff like that. I was actually a graphic designer in a former life. One of my first jobs was a web developer. So I have kind of an interesting, you know, kind of weird skill set, but I have some design background also. But yeah, I draw things out on whiteboards, and what I find is most useful though is to just create it and just start throwing it away. So, you know, the faster you can slam it out, you know, you just start, you know, reworking it as much as possible. Cause the just like your idea for a product is going to change over time, your idea for the design of the product is going to change too. So like some of the real early, you know, versions of Zen don't look anything like, you know, obviously the product that went out. But yeah, just, you know, an iterative kind of cycle, you know, just like software design for me is, you know, real similar.
Well, I think, you know, I just also want to compliment you on sort of the design of the site. Definitely much nicer design than you would expect from the typical engineer. So it's pretty clear that you have you have some design sensibility there.
Thanks. I appreciate it. So, yeah, like I said, I mean, it's, you know, user experience are, you know, very important, you know, to us. That's really the number one thing that we wanted to get right. So. Because, you know, there's other tools, of course, there's other project management tools that are available out there, but, you know, a lot of them are just kind of bogged down with features, you know, feature bloat, which is kind of ironic too, because a lot of them, you know, are agile project management tools, so to speak, but, you know, they end up with 1,000 features that, you know, very few people use. And the problem is, you know, once you end up with so many features, your user interface starts to get so complex that your user experience starts to degrade. And so, you know, our goal was to create something that was, you know, simple and very open-ended, so you can take it and kind of mold it into whatever you, you know, want it to be. But again, you know, focusing on, you know, the end user experience above all else, really.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your technology stack.
Sure.
You know, the pieces that you use to build it.
Yep. It's ASP.NET MVC. Behind the scenes, it stands on top of and Hibernate then too, and actually Linkfur and Hibernate is the with a repository kind of pattern. Back at CodeMash in January, James Avery and I were kind of sitting around and hacking on some code, and we came up with what we called Zelda, which is this link repository pattern with query objects and things like that. And actually I was going to open source it and start blogging about it, but I never got around to it. And anyhow, so that was the foundation of the you know, the data access layer in Zen. But then on top of that, of course, it's just a whole bunch of jQuery, lots and lots of jQuery, which is a fantastic toolkit, by the way. If you're writing websites at all, you know, and you need any sort of JavaScript, jQuery is absolutely, you know, a vital tool. Just doing all kinds of stuff, you know, things like animation and, but even just the simple DOM manipulation stuff that you have to do in JavaScript. If you need to do any of that stuff, jQuery just makes it so unbelievably simple. I mean, they're just, you know, every day almost as I was writing it, I would have a moment where I was like, it can't possibly be that simple. And it was, so.
So, you know, like most nerds, or I don't know, like some nerds, first thing I did when I first started using it, and I thought, wow, this is cool, and play with the drag and drop and set up a project and, you know, make up silly tasks and stuff. Step two, of course, is view source, you know, and so I was looking through And like I said to you before the call, I mean, the markup, CSS, and JavaScript are so, you know, like I was calling it, you know, like HTML pornography, because it's just so beautiful, you know. It's just like one thing that I thought was interesting was the use of you've got a CSS browser selector that mm-hmm. used, right? So you want to talk about that, like how that helped you write cross browser CSS?
Yeah, absolutely. That was something that I actually just stumbled on when looking for ways to avoid hacking. So, I mean, you know, if you've ever done website development, you know, to try to get cross browser stuff, you got to start writing hacks for everything. Fortunately, we made the decision early on to forego support for IE6. So that kind of saved us a lot of hacking, you know, overall. But what that little bit of JavaScript does is it actually sets classes on your HTML tag. So like if you're viewing, you know, if the user's viewing it in Firefox, it'll get a Gecko class set on the HTML. And so what you can do then is just use, you know, the cascading nature of CSS to set, you know, browser specific tags, you know, right in line in your regular style sheets. So rather than having to understand how, okay, this browser misinterprets CSS in this way, so I can use the star HTML hack and, you know, all that stuff, we were able to avoid that. And that was definitely very, very helpful. And it's pretty cool too. All you got to do is just drop in, you know, browser.js, and it, you know, sets all that stuff up for you.
Were there other jQuery plugins or you know, includes or things like that that really stood out as things that really helped quite a bit?
Oh yeah, jQuery UI it drives pretty much the whole site. So all the drag and drop and sortable stuff, you know, the whole board is really driven by jQuery UI. So that's great. Then of course, you know, the jQuery form plugin and the validation plugin, and that's a really fantastic thing about jQuery too, is that it's got this whole ecosystem of plugins around it. I'm really jealous of their model actually too, because they've set it up to the point where they can just, you know, focus on the core product, and, you know, all of the extensions that happen around it are all supported by the community. That's something actually I'm trying to go towards in Inject 2, which is going to be released relatively soon once I wrap up some more Zen work and get back to it. But, you know, again, focus on just the core and then try to, you know, create an easy extensibility model around it. So, you know, if people want specific features rather than adding directly into the core, they can just write an extension. I think that's a great model for software, because otherwise you end up with feature bloat in the core, and the more features you add in, the more you degrade. You know, again, I'm going to rant more about user experience, but it happens in libraries too, just like with actual software that has user interface. I mean, the more features, the harder it is for the base case, you know? So that's the most important thing, is try to keep the base case as simple as possible. So I probably have, I'd say maybe 20 jQuery plugins that I use in different areas and, you know, that sort of stuff.
And were you able to build the bulk or all of the UI with just sort of off-the-shelf plugins, or did you have to create your own sort of componentry as well?
Well, it's a little bit of both, because a lot of the jQuery plugins are kind of low-level sort of things. So even like jQuery UI, it handles, like, for example, the sortable extension that you can use. It handles the ability to, you know, drag and drop, you know, divs on your web page, but you have to be able to do something with those events when it happens. It's not as easy as like just dropping a control on a page or anything like that. You know, I mean, you still have to really wire it into the infrastructure of your system, you know, pretty closely. But yeah, I mean, overall, you know, the complexity of, if I had to sit down and write that myself, it would have been really difficult. So the ability to, you know, just grab that and drop it in. And again, you got to catch the events and, you know, handle all that stuff. But in comparison, it's really simple.
And then one, you know, I guess kind of this is just how it would have to work, but I was looking, like, the when you drag and drop stuff around, then you're making AJAX calls in the background back to mm-hmm. that are saving the state of what's going on. So, like, browser crash, or I just close the browser, and obviously you've maintained everything that I've done. Was that tricky at all to set up, or?
Yeah, it's definitely a different kind of mindset. So, you know, when I originally started writing software, it was really, you know, a lot of the early stuff I did was WinForm stuff. And so, you know, it kind of is a different mindset when you start doing those kind of things on the web because it is all async. So, you know, that's actually a real challenge too in terms of like UI because, you know, for example, if you drag and drop a card on the Zen board, you'll see a little progress indicator flash on the card. You know, just little tricks like that that are kind of helpful to, you know, indicate that something is happening that hasn't finished yet. Of course, there's really no such thing as synchronous UI, you know, on the web. Like, it's just not, you know, set up to do that. There are tricks that you can use to make it work that way and just say this call is synchronous and you know, I can't continue on until it works. That's not a great UI practice anyway, of course, you know, because you lock up the user interface in the meantime. So that's kind of weak. But it's definitely particularly when you get into like the dynamic scoping of JavaScript and stuff like that, you end up with callbacks that call callbacks and you have to manage, you know, what your this reference is all the time. So it's kind of confusing sometimes. But that's actually another area that jQuery really shines in, you know, managing the concept of this, you know, even once you get into nested functions and stuff like that.
Right. I remember that was one of the first things that I really just banged my head against in JavaScript was the whole this, like what's your scope and what this means. And it's like not what you'd expect from C# and just kind of blew my mind for several days.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, coming from an OOP kind of background, I mean, you know, this has a very strong meaning, you know, in an object-oriented language. And when you go to a functional language like JavaScript, you know, it really changes everything and you have to kind of twist your brain around it a little bit. So it was very difficult for me too in the beginning.
So so out there in the startup world, you know, you don't really see the cool kids building on a Microsoft stack all that much.
That's true.
were you ever tempted to look at something like Rails or, you know, some other platform, or did you knew .NET, so that's what you wanted to go with?
Oh, sure. I mean, I was tempted to use Rails. I mean, I've tinkered with Rails and, you know, built some little projects with it and stuff like that. And I actually really love Ruby as a language. I think it's very cool. But it came down to a question of, well, you know, when you're doing a startup, everything is all about ROI. Like, I mean, you've got to get your return on investment. Every minute, you know, that you're spending is your money, basically. So like, you know, we haven't taken any outside investment or anything like that. I mean, we're not, you know, a venture backed startup or anything. So it's just me and my wife and we're bootstrapping, you know, we're self-funded and that sort of thing. So we have to focus 100% of our effort on, you know, reducing costs and doing things as fast and as efficiently really as possible. So what it comes down to is for me, my skill set is still very strong in .NET and not very strong in Rails. And so, you know, it was just like, well, I could either go learn Rails, you know, while I'm writing this and write something that looks like a .NET developer wrote it, but in Ruby, you know, because that's always how your first project comes out when you switch platforms like that. Or I could say, okay, well, you know, I'm already pretty skilled with the tools that I understand, you know, the Microsoft stack. Why don't I just use those? You know, sure, use some things on the fringe, you know, stuff like MVC and Linkfer and Hibernate and that kind of stuff. But, you know, be much more efficient with it overall. So really, I think what it comes down to is we really approached it as, you know, this is going to be a product. Maybe not early on. It was just something I was tinkering with. But when we recognized that the real way to make it work is to, you know, sell it, we really focused on getting that maximum return on investment, you know, for the time. So I think a lot of people, like, you know, they'll sit down and, you know, hobbyists or, you know, something like that, like, okay, I'm going to go write something to learn how to write Ruby, for example. I think if you're launching a product, like, it's okay to do that, you know, but if you're really serious about, you know, you're going to start a company, you should always go with your, you know, best skill, like, you know, what you feel most comfortable with. The only thing, honestly, I was concerned about was hosting fees. So originally when we first started it, I was writing it to be deployed on Mono to try to avoid the Windows hosting fees. That's really not that big of a deal, as I found, because I found I was spending more time trying to make it work under Mono than I was just if I were to pay for the Windows boxes, you know, to host it. So it was like kind of came out in the wash. But And that's nothing against Mono. I was trying to develop on Windows and then deploy to Mono. And then there's just very slight differences between the two, particularly when you do ASP.NET. So it was just a matter of, I just said, I can't worry about that. You know, I just have to focus on getting the product done. So, and actually now we're BizSpark members anyway, so it doesn't much matter.
What sort of things did you run into? Was it like MVC related stuff or?
In terms of like Mono weaknesses?
Yeah.
Honestly, I think it was mostly just like infrastructure stuff. So it was, you know, trying to get the Mono ASP.NET, you know, system working in Apache or Nginx. And it was just, you know, that kind of stuff. It wasn't so much individual like code things that I can remember. It may have just been I never even got to that point. Like I gave up because I couldn't get the infrastructure working. But
because
my original idea was I was going to spin up a bunch of slices. So, you know, as necessary, I would go and get these virtual machines, you know, on something like SliceHost or, you know, the Mosso Cloud or whatever it's called, Rackspace Cloud now, you know, and then just set it up kind of like a web farm. Part of the problem there was I was thinking too far in the future anyway. It's like I was worrying about scalability, which is, you know, the number one thing that you really shouldn't worry about, you know, right away. It's just, you know, solve that. That's a good problem to have. So solve it when you have it, you know, that sort of thing.
Wait for the fail whales to scale.
Right. Yep. Right. And actually, you know, Twitter caught a lot of flack for that sort of thing. But, you know, from a certain perspective, you know, I understand why they did it the way they did it. And, you know, they just couldn't respond, you know, as quickly to the kind of, you know, massive growth that they saw. But I mean, had they have sat down and tried to solve that problem in advance, you might not have ever gotten to market. You know, I mean, you have to, there's certain things that you have to be, you know, very diligent about. You know, for example, if you're using ORM, like in Hibernate, you got to be very careful not to do N+1 stuff. So, you know, run in queries for getting a collection of data. Those like very dangerous things that you really should avoid, you know, are easy to avoid too. You just have to be, you know, diligent. But things like micro optimization, you can really get down into some dark territory if you start chasing that stuff, particularly again, you know, as, you know, from the startup mindset, you have to really focus on like, again, you know, all of my time. This is like, you know, money. For every key that I hit on my keyboard is money going down the drain, you know, that sort of thing. Like, so, you know, I got to get the maximum value out of it.
Right. So speaking of ORMs, did you already say that you're using nHibernate or what's your data access?
Yeah, nHibernate.
Okay. nHibernate against SQL Server or what?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Right now. That'll probably stay that way for a while too, I figure. Just because I've got all the hosting set up for it and everything like that. But again, you know, one of the nice things about nHibernate is you can switch easily too if, you know, I wanted to go to, you know, MySQL or whatever, something else, you know, that sort of thing. But actually, the SQL Server's been great. I mean, I've used it, you know, professionally for a while now too. And so, again, it's what I'm most comfortable with. So why not use it?
Right.
Yeah, it's really kind of unfortunate, I think, too, that, you know, a lot of the it's not cool, quote unquote, to, you know, use the Microsoft stack to launch a company. Because, I mean, it, you know, there's definitely some weak spots in the tools, just like every other tool, you know, but overall, it's fantastic. I mean, it's been great. And you can I think you can churn out good software, you know, using Microsoft tools. So particularly MVC. MVC is a huge leap, you know, in the right direction. And major kudos to Phil Hack and the team, you know, for doing that. It was, yeah, big difference than versus web forms. And of course, I'd used Monorail before that. But, you know, it's nice to see Microsoft take a, you know, personal interest in, you know, trying to improve that sort of stuff. I've never been a big web forms fan. Also, I have to say, too, the Spark View engine is fantastic. Absolutely, any MVC project that I do in the future will use the Spark View engine. Absolutely. It just makes everything so simple. It's just like, you know, again, I had the same kind of experience, too, with that. It's just like, there's no way this can be that easy. But it is. So,
were there any big issues, any big gotchas that you ran into with, you know, with the stack, with MVC, with nHibernate, with, you know, with Spark, or was it all pretty smooth?
It was all relatively smooth overall. There's some, there's some strangeness, you know, that happens. Again, I'm using Linkfer and Hibernate. So, and that's like, I don't even know if it's, I guess they call it alpha. I don't even think it's reached beta yet. But, you know, it's stable enough that it works pretty well. But basically, you know, what that does is gives you a link layer on top of your, you know, in Hibernate system. So it plugs right into your session and actually generates criteria that gets executed. So sometimes, again, I think it's just because it's bleeding edge kind of software. You can get a link expression that it tries to interpret the expression tree in a way that it's not exactly right. Things like, for example, nullable types. It doesn't really understand nullable types real well. So if you have a nullable type on your entity that you're running a query on, it can misinterpret what you mean by that dot value as part of the, you know, the struct that creates the nullable type. So you can get weird errors there that can easily be solved by pulling things into memory and then running, you know, link statements, you know, using just, you know, link to objects rather than, you know, actually pushing it down into, you know, the SQL statements.
So you mentioned Spark View Engine, and we haven't really talked about that on the podcast before. How would you compare that to like the WebForms View Engine, which is, you know, I mean, that's kind of more the, you know, alligator tags and the kind of scripting as you're used to, it's similar to the scripting you're used to seeing in, you know, WebForms or even sort of classic ASP.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sure.
Yeah. So how is Spark different from that?
Well, Spark, I think, trends towards simplicity versus WebForms. So, I mean, like you have the WebForms View Engine is great to try to get people started, I think, in the progress of moving from WebForms to MVC, you know, and then to just like raw HTML. So if you have experience with that sort of thing, it's a good way to start. For me, I actually came into, you know, web development through PHP. It was the first thing I used. So I'm used to knocking out the HTML, you know, by hand and not having a lot of control support and stuff like that you get in web forms. And again, I've never really bought completely into the web forms concept of, you know, creating user controls and, you know, that sort of thing. I really think that your HTML is very important, you know, that a lot of people want to treat it like, you know, an abstraction that you don't want to deal with. What Spark lets you do is it actually embraces HTML. It just says HTML is what we're using. So, okay, let's put some more logic into it, make it smarter. So you get things like if attributes or each attributes. So you can do something like, you know, create a UL, for example, you know, a list, and then you can say li each equals, and you can actually write a C# statement in that attributes value that becomes a for each statement. And so you can actually then generate, it's almost works like a repeater, you know, in web form. So you can actually generate, you know, multiple LIs inside that list, just with that one line of code. So it just does little stuff like that. Again, when you look at a Spark view, it looks like HTML. It doesn't really look like, you know, a collection of controls or anything like that. I mean, you can really read it like a web page, which is, I love that personally. I mean, I think HTML is the essence of your website. I mean, it's not an abstraction that you should ignore. It's something that you really have to, you know, focus on. So Spark really helps with that.
And what do you lose, if anything, in the sort of design time, IntelliSense, you know, development experience when you're using an alternate view engine?
Yeah, you lose all your design time stuff. Of course, I don't know if you get design time with WebForms view engine. I haven't tried it. The Spark does have IntelliSense, although it's still a little bit wonky because it's still like, you know, alpha code. I actually found that I'd never really needed it because I think if you're relying a lot on your IntelliSense inside your views are too complex. I mean, the more code you add to your view, the more dangerous that view becomes because really most of your logic should be put, you know, in your controller. And, you know, particularly, you know, in web forms, you had code behind, but it was like, okay, well, you ended up writing a bunch of inline code anyway inside your markup. And so now that you have the controller, you know, it's a lot easier to do all that pre-processing and generate the, you know, the stuff that you have to push into your view data and then just dump it either in the view data dictionary or in your model and then just push it over to the view. And then the view doesn't really do anything, you know, processing wise. It just takes that information and renders it. So, you know, comes up with a way to display that information, you know, in HTML format. So I actually don't even have the IntelliSense stuff turned on for Spark. I never have. Part of that's just because when I started using it, there was no IntelliSense, and so I just got used to it. But it's surprisingly unnoticeable, honestly. Like I can't tell the difference.
So talking about the, you know, how things are passed around, like, do you use what's your architecture as far as, like, do you use a presentation model, view model type of thing, or do you use, you know, what sort of pattern inside of MVC are you using?
I actually just, I'm a big believer, oddly enough, in just jamming stuff in the view data dictionary and pulling it out, you know, in your view. One of the cool things that Spark also lets you do is it actually gives you a view data tag that you can put at the top of your view. And basically what it does is it strong types the contents of your view data dictionary. So one of the main reasons why I think there's a big backlash against using view data dictionary, you know, the, you know, weak typed kind of dictionary. And I actually found that really is kind of irrelevant when you use Spark, because you can say, okay, the item in my dictionary with the key user is of type user, you know, my entity user. And so, you know, I don't have a lot of strong type models for, you know, view models, that is. Now, when I post forms back from the view, a lot of that is strong type. So I use, you know, the model binder in MVC to get those kind of complex objects posted back from, you know, my views. That's very helpful in that respect, because otherwise you end up with actions that have 14 different parameters to them. I'm sure that some other people would say that using view data dictionary is, you know, blasphemy, but I actually, it works great for me. If you embrace it, and again, with Spark, it works fine.
So one thing I noticed is inside the markup, you've got attributes that say like Zen colon data, and then you have like, you know, IDs and stuff like that. Is that something that you've kind of come up with yourself, or is that a pattern that's, you know, like a common pattern or something?
Actually, that's the jQuery metadata plugin, which is another one of the things I use, is actually really cool. What that lets you do is you can just write JSON inside that attribute's value. And then there's just a real simple method that you can call metadata on any jQuery object, and it'll read that attribute. And of course, you can set what name you want that attribute to be, and it'll grab the JSON out of there and turn it in, you know, it'll val it in JavaScript, and it'll create an actual object. So that's the way that I get like the internal identifiers that you never actually see, you know, see in the application. But then, you know, to do those AJAX calls and stuff like that, you know, it grabs that metadata and uses that. So it actually can read from all different places too. It's a pretty cool plugin. So places like the class, you can set things in there, or you can create an attribute. Then there's different pros and cons of each method. I think technically, since I have an attribute that way, I can't validate on HTML, or, you know, there's some sort of reason why some people use the CSS class versus that, but it explains it all in the jQuery metadata stuff.
Yeah, that was the one thing I was thinking, is I've used classes for that reason, to validate XHTML, although nobody really cares about that except the people that kind of, you know, crush you for using the wrong, you know, for not validating. You know, I mean, it's not.
Yeah. A lot. I mean, validation's good. I think it's important, but I think it's kind of overblown. The amount of, you know, it's the necessity of it, I think, is overestimated, because you end up, you know, hacking to try to, you know, get each individual browser to work anyway. And so a lot of times you have to go away from your, you know, validatable or whatever XHTML in order to make it work. So working is, I think, the priority of above all else.
So since you mentioned the multiple browser issue, I assume you support the big three, at least, big four now, I guess, with the way you did markup and using jQuery. How much work was that for you? I mean, did it end up being a lot of niggly stuff, or was it fairly straightforward in modern browsers?
Honestly, overall, it's not that bad. Again, the key word there is modern browsers. So I mentioned before that we just kind of ignored IE6. We just said that for our target market, which of course is, you know, right now is software developers, most people don't have IE6. And so, you know, we just said, okay, IE7, IE8, Firefox, and WebKit-based browsers, you know, Safari and Chrome. So, and actually, the majority of, once you're in strict mode and, you know, all that sort of thing, it's pretty basic. I mean, there's a few things that are a little bit weak. IE's box model is still slightly different than others. And of course, there's a whole big argument, you know, whether the W3C box model, you know, the real box model of CSS is screwed up in the first place. But overall, I mean, it, you know, it really wasn't that bad. There are some places that it still doesn't quite look great in IE7. And, I did my best to clean that stuff up before launch, but at the end of the day, if it doesn't look perfect, it's still not the end of the world because people, you know, we actually have quite a few users on IE7 and no one's really complained that, you know, it's off by one pixel here and there. So yeah, overall I have to say it was surprisingly painless because I've gone through quite a few times when, you know, trying to get it to work for cross browser and it took forever. I think the key there is to ignore IE6. And we've actually had a couple of people ask us, you know, why doesn't it look good? You know, what's wrong with this site? You know, I don't understand. I'm missing something. And it always turns out that they're using IE6. And my answer to them is, I'm sorry, but, you know, we just decided to spend our resources somewhere else. And it's like, you know, I feel bad. You know, I don't want to turn anyone away. But at the same time, for us, it's just not cost effective to go and support a browser that's, I don't know, 6 years old or however old it is now. So
I would just show them a big, you know, like, go home IE6.
Whatever. Right. Well, there's actually a pretty cool piece of JavaScript that creates what looks like, you know, almost the ActiveX sort of warning thing at the top of your browser. I can't remember the name of it, but I almost put that in there just to, and you click it and it'll actually take you to Microsoft's website where you can, you know, upgrade to IE7. I would put that in there, you know, to try to help people. But the bottom line is that the people that are coming to use Xen, or if they're using IE6, it's because they're being forced to by, you know, IT or something like that, you know, in terms of their business. So it's unlikely that would really help anyone. It would, you know. Now, I could see that like on a normal website, you know, if it's just like anybody can browse to it and then it's mass market sort of thing, not a web application like we're doing, that would probably be very helpful.
So who was it that put up that survey? Simone Chiaretta, I think. Simone Chiaretta? Yeah. He had a survey that I think it was him that asked, why are you running IE6? And yeah, it was, like you said, the top two reasons were either IT makes me and I don't have administrative access on my machine. So yep. There's like two classes of sophistication there.
Sure.
The people who can't and the people who don't know how.
Right. And I mean, the bottom line is, you know, it's again, so simple now to even support IE7 and above, you know, along with the rest of the browsers. I mean, I think I probably have about I don't know, 20 hacks maybe total to my CSS, you know, to support all of the major browsers. And again, it's not perfect, so I probably need a few more than that. But IE6 would have, you know, I guarantee it would have had, you know, double that easily and would have been hours and hours of time, you know, spent. And honestly, the bottom line is there's so few people that use IE6 anymore, you know, in our demographic that it doesn't make any sense. You know, I could be spending my time in 100 other ways that are more productive and better, you know, overall for our customers.
Odds are if people are doing lean development with Kanban boards, they're probably not stuck on IE6.
Right, exactly. That's kind of what we figured, yeah.
Well, actually we are. We're at Getty. We're not, but some of the teams upstairs are doing Kanban. They just have sticky notes on cubicle walls. But yeah, of course we support IE6 because it's still in our browser makeup of our users.
Sure.
Which is kind of strange considering that I think designers are 90% of our clients.
That is kind of ironic actually. Yeah.
I can see, I mean, we're still supporting Safari too, and I can see that. Because that's like, apparently that is huge in Japan.
Oh, huh.
So you may run into that, I guess, if Toyota picks up your tool. You may right. support Safari too.
Yeah, no, that's actually, when we first launched, I had only tested in Safari 4, I believe, the latest version. And actually, we had a couple of problems in Safari 3X, and I didn't realize it. So there was actually another really cool tool that someone gave to me, actually James Avery, I think, which was this, it actually is virtualization in your browser. So it's just like a browser plugin, but you just go to this website, you can click, you know, a link, and it actually will pop up a new browser, you know, that acts just like, you know, say Safari. So like, you know, I can actually go there and use Safari, you know, on my Vista box without actually having to, you know, install OS 10 and all that. I have a Mac, although my wife stole it, but it's just nice to be able to just sit down and test on all different browsers. There's other, you know, sites that are services, you know, like they can take screenshots, you know, use these big swarms of systems to take screenshots on different browsers. And I'd used that before. I think Browser Shots is what it's called. But, you know, obviously if you have a web application that's all about, you know, clicking and moving through things and, you know, dragging and dropping and that kind of stuff, screenshots aren't really that helpful. So yeah, the virtualization stuff is pretty cool.
I think the one you're talking about there is Xenocode, XEN.
Ah, yeah, that's it.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, that and I use IE Tester just for IE, and then I found too that except for the font rendering stuff, you can get away with a lot of the Safari testing with just using the Windows Safari. But when you font rendering differences are enough that they can screw up a pixel tight layout. Been dealing with that a bit lately.
Yeah, I do all my main browser now is actually Chrome, but I do all the development in Firefox because of Firebug. That's the one thing I used to use Firefox all the time, but I can't get away from it completely because I'm addicted to Firebug and all of the extensions that you can get, like FireCookie and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Have you looked at the developer tools in Safari 4?
No, I actually haven't.
They're getting pretty close to Firebug. They've got a JavaScript profiler. They've got the inspect element. They've got all of that kind of stuff. I think they even have the layout tab, mm-hmm. which I use constantly. I don't know about the rest of you, but trying to tweak margins and everything in that.
Yeah, definitely.
So you might look at that. The JavaScript debugger was a little bit hard for me to get started using. And so, yeah, I'm kind of like you. I'm still using Firebug and Firefox. But I'm starting to lean more on Safari. I think websites just look better in Safari and WebKit in general. I don't know. People disagree with me, but when I'm staring at a site all day in Firefox and IE, and then I switch over to Safari, I notice colors just seem crisper. The fonts are cleaner. Everything just looks better. I don't know why.
Yeah, I think the Mac font rendering in general is far superior, which is kind of weird too, because there was that whole, I don't know, I think it was Jeff Atwood talked about that, where it just basically takes it and just bolds it a little bit and it ends up being, you know, it looks cleaner in a certain respect. But yeah, I agree though. I think things look better in Chrome for some reason. It may just be, you know, in my head, but there's some things that aren't quite that great. But they're all like kind of fringe features, like CSS3, like rounded corners and stuff like that. So like I actually use some of those features in Xen. Of course, it degrades, you know, to normal corners if you, you know, if your browser doesn't support it. In IE, it's not supported.
Have you looked at any of the 3D CSS transforms in Safari yet?
No. Mm-mm.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if you'd want to do that, but there's all sorts of crazy crap you could do.
Yeah, there's all kinds of new stuff in CSS3, and I still haven't had a chance to like really dig that far into it, because part of it is, again, it's so fringe, like, still, you know, I hesitate to implement a lot of it because, you know, who knows how much of it's actually going to work and, you know, that sort of stuff. So
I was wondering, speaking of that stuff, I was wondering, looking at the charts, that was one place where you're using I believe it's AM charts or AM charts or whatever, mm-hmm. and it's just kind of a simple Flash plugin. And, you know, that's one place where, like, obviously the smart decision in terms of running a business, but, you know, the geek in me is like, well, is there, you know, like there's what, X Canvas and things like that, that basically like use the Canvas support or SVG support that's in modern browsers and then uses VML and IE. But did you evaluate different options, or was it just pretty clear that, you know, like a Flash-based charting engine was the way to go?
No, I actually did look at the Canvas-based stuff too, because I'd seen it, you know, a while back and was like, oh, that's pretty cool. I never really done anything with Canvas until I saw that. And really what it came down to is it's easier to just drop the Flash chart into place and pump XML into it, which is really all it does. You know, which is really simple with MVC. I mean, you just come up with a model that looks like what they're looking for in terms of the XML, and, you know, just start building an object hierarchy and then just render it back to the charting system. It was just so much easier to do that and not really even have to think about it, you know, than getting into the Canvas-based stuff. I think part of it is, you know, Canvas-based, you know, JavaScript systems are typically how they're set up. They're just not quite to that level of sophistication yet. But it's definitely something. I mean, if there was one out there that I could use, I'd be all over it. Again, the lighter, the better. And if I don't have to use Flash, then that's great. So AmCharts is great, though, overall, in terms of, you know, just if you're looking for a charting system, you know, it's just, it couldn't be simpler.
Did you look at the Google charting engine? I don't know if that's dynamic.
Yeah, it's I did look at it. Briefly, but it's one thing that I'm not really comfortable with using a lot of those kind of hosted, you know, library sort of things. I think hosted applications are great. I mean, like, you know, I don't install a whole lot of software anymore. I mean, everything that I use is web-based, and, you know, I love that sort of thing. Software as a service is great. Of course, I guess I'm kind of biased because, you know, Zen is a software as a service sort of system. But that being said, I don't know how I feel about, you know, using the, you know, the library based sort of things like that. Like, Google also has, you know, the ability to, you know, load jQuery and, you know, other commonly used libraries and stuff like that, you know, from their CDN, their, you know, whatever, content distribution network or content delivery network, whatever that acronym is. But, you know, I'm kind of wary about that sort of thing also too, because, you know, it's all about having, you know, multiple points of failure in that respect is a bad thing, you know. So if one day all of a sudden their CDN stops working for whatever reason, all of a sudden my application's down. So for something like that too, like, you know, speed differences is pretty minimal. But in terms of the charting toolkit, it's pretty cool. I think it's just very basic, though. It's not really robust enough for the stuff that I was hoping to do with it. And honestly, Zen's charting system is not extremely complex or anything like that, at least not yet, and hopefully never will be complex, I guess. But, you know, in terms of like having lots of different kinds of charts and that sort of thing, we probably could have gotten away with doing something like, you know, Google Charts or something like that, but we figured, you know, might as well do it, you know, the quote-unquote right way up front, and, you know, get, again, a better user experience overall, you know, because the Flash charts, I think, look better than a lot of the other, you know, alternatives that you can get. So again, with our focus on user experience, you know, it seemed like the right option.
So that works. That works now when you're kind of small still and starting up. But at some point, I mean, yeah, God willing, you'll get to the point where you have to lean on some kind of CDN like Akamai,
mm-hmm,
or something else. And so I've heard the arguments before against using Google CDN. I kind of look at it like, if Google goes down, you know, we're all in deep doo-doo.
Sure.
And I can't imagine a point where I would be more worried about them changing the API than I would about it going down. But yeah, it's always, and I think all the projects that I've worked on, without exception, have always self-hosted their own JavaScript libraries and everything else, and they've just scaled up by throwing, you know, hardwares or VMs at it.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in using a CDN. Like, you know, again, Mosso has, or I guess again, Rackspace now. Rackspace Cloud Files, whatever it is now, is a pretty cool CDN, and also, of course, CloudFront, you know, from Amazon. those are actually both things that I'm looking for attachments is something that is coming up on the horizon for Zen, you know, being able to attach files to stories. And so the storage of that will probably end up being something like S3 or, you know, some sort of cloud service, you know, storage. And so a CDN then naturally makes sense. And then once it's there, I can start using it for other things like, you know, the image files and JavaScript and that kind of stuff. My kind of rule of thumb is that I don't really trust services that I don't understand how they make money. So, you know, again, Google's got so much money, they don't need to worry about it, you know, because all of their other businesses are just fine. But then, you know, what's to stop them, if it's not a revenue center, what's to stop them from saying, okay, that's shut down now. Maybe we're not going to use it anymore. And sure, okay, something like that is simple enough to, okay, they're not hosting jQuery anymore. Okay, no problem. I'll host it locally, or I'll come up, you know, I'll do another CDN. But if they lost, like, you know, let's say I built things on the charting system. All of a sudden they say, well, you know, you can't have that for free anymore. We're going to charge you, or we're, you know, there's cutbacks. We laid off all the people that, you know, in a riff that were working on that. So that's not going to be around anymore. So, you know, those kind of things would cause like an emergency situation where I'd have to go like rewrite something. So again, like something like the Rackspace option or the Amazon option, it's like I'm paying for that. So I feel like they're not just going to take it away, or it would be much more difficult for them to say, okay, we're just not offering this anymore. You know, at least they would have to give a little bit more notice, you know, before they did that.
So since you mentioned paying for things, your service is in fact a pay service,
mm-hmm.
Or has paid versions. I mean, there's a free version for small projects. I'm just a little curious as to, like, you know, how that hooking that all up went. Like, what is that, you know, is that a really straightforward thing to do, to hook up payment processing to a, you know, a website, or was there a lot of pain around that?
It wasn't really that bad. It was really, that was the first time I've ever actually done that. I'd kind of tinkered with systems that had already been written in some of my previous jobs, you know, so-called e-commerce system. But the gateway that we're using is called Braintree Payment Solutions. They've been really, really great. Their API is just so clean and so well thought out. Like, you can tell, you know, developers were very serious, again, you know, about user experience. And so that makes it very simple. They actually have a thing called transparent redirect. So if you look at the forms on any of the payment screens for Zen, they actually all post to their system. So rather than worry about things like that you have to start thinking about when you take credit cards, PCI compliance and, you know, heightened security and, you know, those sort of things, we kind of just offload that onto them. So what happens is, of course, it's all, you know, SSL, but when it posts over to, you know, their system, they do whatever process is necessary, and then they send a 302 redirect back to our system with additional information, you know, yes, this credit card went through the processing system, it's approved, you know, that sort of stuff. So in that respect, we never touch any of the credit cards. They actually never enter our servers. It goes directly from the client to their system and then back. And so what we get, they have a feature called the Vault. And so we store customer information in there. Accounts will have credit card information that's all stored in there, you know, secure, PCI compliant, et cetera, with guards on the roofs and, you know, snipers and whatever other turrets that they need to be PCI compliant. And so they handle all that. And we just get a token that says, you know, okay, customer 123. And we just store that with our user record. And then whenever, you know, again, Zen is a monthly service. So every month we just kind of ping them and say, okay, go bill this customer $29 because they're on the pro plan, or $9 because they're on the personal plan, you know, that sort of thing. But in terms of, you know, integrating with Braintree, it, you know, again, one of those things that really couldn't be easier. Yeah, I mean, I looked at some other, you know, alternatives, things like PayPal and Amazon's new payment system and stuff like that. And really, just from an ease of use perspective, none of the other ones really, you know, compared at all. So it's actually really cool, too, how transparent redirect works. And I don't know if they came up with that, if they were the first ones to use that kind of system, or if, you know, they just offer it. But, you know, it really makes things simple. And so, of course, my first reaction was, well, I have to put the cost, you know, the amount that I'm charging, like, right into the form, You know, I can't control that server side or anything like that. So how do I, you know, what stops people from just saying, okay, yeah, this product costs $0, you know, sign me up. But it actually uses, you know, kind of a public-private key sort of hash system too. So there's like a private key that you get assigned, and you have to build up this string and then hash it just, you know, with MD5 and put that hash in your form value. And so then when you post, it does the same thing, hashes the values and says, okay, yes, this matches. And then when you get your response back, you get another hash as well using your private key. You can't get away with, you know, altering things like the cost, and, you know, the important information is all protected inside that hash. And so you can do validation in that respect.
What was the sort of total development time? Was this something you were working on sort of nights and weekends for a long time, or?
Yes. for as long as I can remember. Yeah. I'd actually started the very early version when I was at my previous job, and then I went and worked for Telligent and worked on it, you know, again throughout that whole time. And, you know, of course, only nights, weekends, you know, while holding full-time job. So it was just kind of like, okay, 5 o'clock rolls around. It's like, okay, I'm going to go eat dinner, and then I'm going to come back, and it's going to be second shift. I'm going to work on Zen. And then, you know, weekends, same way. I'd say, you know, kind of a rough estimate, I'd say probably, I'm probably getting close now to about 1,000 hours put into it overall. Again, it's been a long time coming, so it may not be that high. But also, I actually left Telligent in early June to try to wrap, you know, the product up and get it ready for launch. And we launched on the 7th of July. And so that period of time in between there was, I don't even know what happened, honestly. It's just a blur. It's just one big day. That's really all I remember. And it was just a huge amount of, you know, getting everything done and wrapped up. And it was just, but yeah, that's kind of what it takes in a way, to do a startup. There's some people that will tell you that, you know, you absolutely have to work 20 hours a day and all this stuff. And, you know, honestly, that's not really true, because at a certain point, you know, your quality starts to degrade. I mean, every person is capable of working only a certain amount of hours a day. And after that, you're creating negative work. You know, you're not really creating any value. But when you have a full-time job, you know, and you're required to spend 8 hours a day on that, the only option is to go to the second shift and, you know, push yourself a little bit further. And I mean, fortunately for me, you know, I'm used to that sort of thing through work on open source like Ninject and, you know, that kind of stuff. That used to be what I spent my time on, you know, at nights and on weekends and stuff like that. Cause, you know, like a lot of geeks, I love to program, and, you know, I'm happy I get paid for it. So, you know, it's a cool feeling to be able to do that. But it just comes down to, you know, sometimes that's what it takes, and you just have to, you know, put the extra effort in and you know, sit down and write the product. So I think it's really easy to have an idea, and this isn't me patting myself on the back or anything like that, but it's really easy to have an idea and say, I'm going to do this. It's very difficult to get from that point, you know, to launch, to actually having a product. Like, an idea and a product are two absolutely different things. I just read a book not too long ago by Seth Godin called The Dip, and it talks about how there's always a process where it's difficult to get through a one phase. Like, you'll end up in what he calls the dip, which is kind of like a gut check moment where you have to decide, like, either, you know, I'm going to quit this, or I'm going to be as good as I can possibly be. He sums it up in saying averages for losers. I felt that very much. I mean, there were several times when, you know, I was very close to just saying, this is not going to work, or, you know, I can't do this anymore. I don't have the time, or, you know, I don't have the patience, or whatever. And, you know, it's tough sometimes to get through those kind of, you know, situations. So it was good to have some people to rely on. And again, I already name dropped them earlier, but James Avery and Mike Eaton and Jamie Davis and Sean Chambers are, you know, we kind of have this IRC channel that we'll talk in sometimes and, you know, bounce ideas off of each other and that sort of stuff. So that was really, you know, invaluable. And of course, obviously, you know, my wife, who's, you know, also my business partner, would have never happened without her, being able to, you know, come in and give me a different kind of perspective, because, you know, I'm used to just talking to a lot of developers. So it's really cool to have somebody that's not a developer, you know, that can give that sort of, you know, outside perspective.
So, yeah, I had some questions surrounding that, too. I'd actually thought maybe we should have your wife on as well to kind of ask about running a business as a husband and wife team, a startup.
Sure.
And the second part is, without, you know, revealing too much of my Nate Kahari stalkingness nature, I believe she's some kind of psychologist or has a degree somewhere around in there. And I thought it was interesting on the Hansel Minutes podcast. Are we supposed to acknowledge other podcasts on ours?
Sure.
Anyway.
We already did. So, and we actually we did mention that her background, too, slightly, just FYI.
See, that's what happens when you come in late. Yeah. You just look stupid.
No, that's
cool. So anyway, I was interested in you'd mentioned and I'll screw it up because I only took Psych 101. That's all I needed for my degree. but there was some sort of way that you compartmentalize thoughts or connect ideas or something like that rather than doing multitasking. Maybe I'm confusing this one. Anyway, you said something smart about that brain stuff and how it thinks about things. And so I was hoping you could elucidate on that.
Let's see. What was I talking? Oh, I bet I was talking about context switching, right? So one of the things in Kanban, you know, is that if you can limit your work in progress, you can stop yourself from thrashing. So, you know, computer memory works. Like, there's only a certain amount of RAM that you can have, and the rest is all swap. So you have to then move pages back and forth between the two. And so really, you know, in a lot of ways, your brain is the same way. So you have your active memory, like, you know, your short-term kind of memory and what you're working on right now. And then you have your long-term memory that, you know, stores things. So kind of like, again, RAM and swap. And so as you're working on something, you have to swap it up into your, you know, short-term memory and hold it there as you're working. And so if you have lots of different tasks that you're working on, you actually end up context switching, and which you can get into a situation that Mary Popenick, you know, a big time person in lean software, calls thrashing, which you can actually spend so much time trying to context switch that you know, it's a huge amount of waste, and you actually find that it's a huge draw on your, you know, available time. And so, again, Kanban, by limiting the work in progress, it seems like you're creating like an artificial bottleneck, you know, and saying, okay, I can't possibly work on any more than this. But it's really just acknowledging the fact that, you know, realistically, you can't be in two places at once. You can only work on one thing at a time. And so why, you know, assign 14 tasks to yourself and then try to decide which one to work on? Instead, you just pick one, you know, pick the next one that you have to do, focus completely on that until it's complete, or at least until you can't get in any further, you know, and then grab the next task off the queue.
So I guess I'm wondering about what her involvement was in terms of the design of the app, because, you know, it's kind of hard for non techies, I guess. Maybe not necessarily, maybe non-techies is the right word, but to think about how we as software developers and program managers and QA and everything produce things, simply because what we produce is so ethereal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so yeah, there's some product that comes out at the end and it looks very simple. But so the non-technical people are either constantly overestimating how much time and how hard something would be, or they think that, you know, yeah, you should just be able to, you know, recompile it, make it work on the Apple IIe, right? And,
sure,
you know, and things like that. And so I'm wondering how much, not necessarily how much input, but if, you know, how much her experience in terms of, you know, cognitive theory and things like that came into play when you were designing the app, and how much you just pulled kind of from the standard project management Kanban literature and your own experience with, you know, developing stuff in an enterprise.
I'd have to say it was probably largely, you know, just pulling from the existing literature and things like that. But I will say, though, that, you know, she helped a lot with like the overall, you know, concept. So like, you know, things like making things easy to adopt if you want, but they're opt-in sort of features. So a lot of stuff like for example, in Zen, you can use estimates. Stories can have sizes. This is really what we call them. But if you don't want to use those, they just don't appear. And so really, you wouldn't even know that they were there unless you, you know, specifically wanted to use estimates. So same thing with WIP limits, work in progress limits on your phases and on your Kanban board. If you don't want them, you just ignore it. And so that kind of concept came from, you know, her seeing the product and particularly seeing our competitors. You know, I actually had her sit down and try to use things like Mingle and target process and stuff like that, and kind of explained where my frustration came from. So, you know, having her kind of perspective on that, again, at the time, not really understanding how software was written, not understanding how an agile process worked, you know, just being able to try to sit down and understand a piece of software like that was very difficult. So I wouldn't say that necessarily we were targeting people that had never been exposed to that kind of stuff with Zen, but we wanted to get to a point where someone could just sit down and use the product without any training. That was, you know, we didn't really want to have a giant manual or, you know, have to send out a battery of consultants or something like that in order to try to get people to use it. Because again, our target is, you know, small teams, mid-sized teams, you know, not necessarily the big enterprising companies that, you know, have 12 different project managers and, you know, that sort of thing. Because I think really that area of the market is really just completely ignored by a lot of the tools that are out there. And so our intent was to try to, you know, focus on those people that just wanted to sit down and get some work done and not worry about, you know, all this ceremony that comes along with the, you know, some of the larger tools. So Nikki was absolutely invaluable in that respect.
So when I listened to you on Hansel Minutes and just kind of thinking of it coming into it, I was thinking, like, could this be approached sort of as a bug tracker? You know, like you have things and they're assigned to different people and they're, you know, they move through different states and that kind of stuff. And after mm-hmm. using it for 2 minutes, I understood, no, totally different things, right? Because, I mean, it's very much, it's a simpler thing. You're dragging things through different states and then they're done. But I did wonder about, like, okay, so say I've got a story I'm working on and then I need to, you know, send it back to somebody else or whatever. How is that something where you just kind of edit the description to say, hey, you know, Nate, can you take a look at this? Or, you know what I mean? Like, how do you facilitate that kind of like history of what's going on with this? Or is that kind of like overthinking how this should be used?
No, that's definitely something that's, you know, well within kind of the parameters of Zen. So there's a few different ways that you can do it. One is you can actually hang a blocked marker on the card. So like if you click a card, you'll see that it expands and then there's a blocked checkbox. If you click it, it'll actually hang a red block around the card, you know,
right,
which you can put a description of, you know, what's wrong with that card. So basically, if you block a card, it means it can't move through your pipeline anymore. And so it kind of calls out, you know, there's a problem. That actually comes from a system called Andon, which is from the Toyota production system. As they're actually manufacturing cars on the assembly line, everybody has a cord, which you can pull. And if you pull that, it stops the process completely. It's called stop the line and sets off sirens and, you know, all kinds of havoc ensues. And the point is that if something like that happens and you see a defect, you know, you should absolutely stop production if it's severe enough that, you know, it's going to interfere with you know, the resulting quality, because it's better to stop production and not continue to produce things that are wrong. It's better to stop, you know, working on what you're doing and go back and fix it and then continue on. So anyway, so a blocked marker would definitely be one of the ways that you can do that. You can also reassign cards too by clicking the avatar, the name in the upper right corner of the card. You can kind of toss the card to someone else. And one of the cool things about Zen too that we really wanted to focus on is it's about communication between the team. So one of the things about Kanban is it's cool to have a board and it's visible and stuff like that. But sometimes communication can break down if people don't vocalize, you know, what's happening on the board. So, okay, I moved this task, you know, or this task is ready to pull, or I moved it to the next queue phase, or, you know, something like that. So people are constantly having to check the Kanban board if you're using a physical board, you know, to understand what's going on. So one of the things in Zen that we focused on is messaging. So messaging is actually a very intrinsic part of the product. So every time somebody does something, it shoots out messages, you know, to everybody that's involved, and then users can customize how they want to be informed. So whether it's via email or via, you know, instant message on Google Talk or, you know, MSN or, you know, all that different stuff, you know, you can set up how you want to be informed of issues.
So one of the things that our team at work, we don't do bug tracking. We pretty much do what, well, not exactly the way that Nate is talking about, but we just create new tasks in our current story, and we work on one story at a time pretty much now. And we just create a new task that has the bug in question. But for the most part, what we've been doing with a lot of success, and I know this is kind of tangential to the product, but we've been pairing not only devs with other devs, but we'll pair QA and dev as they go through and test. So when they see something wrong, we just fix it right then.
Sure.
And then you know, check it in and deploy, and there's no question about whether something's fixed, because we found there was a lot of waste around the whole deploying to a test environment cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you check it in, you got to go through the CI build, and then the CI build deploys up to the test server, and then, you know, everything, all this other stuff has to happen before the QA can actually get in there and test it. And we said, well, why don't we just cut out the middleman and either have them work directly off of our box, or better yet, just have them sit there. And
right.
We just, you know, it's kind of like ping pong developing, except, you know, they test, they find something, pass it over, fix it, pass it back. They sure. Verify that it's fixed and go on.
Yeah, because one of the major sources of waste really is you know, movements or, you know, handoffs that you end up doing, you know, between people. Particularly because, you know, if you think about information, each time you hand off, that information degrades. So, you know, I write a piece of code and I give it to somebody else, you know, maybe to test. I can explain that code as well as I possibly can, but you're losing, you know, some kind of fidelity in that explanation. So no one will understand it as well as I do. Not only that, but once I hand it off, I'm not thinking about it anymore. So even the fidelity of the information in my mind, even being the person that sat down and wrote the software, starts to degrade, again, from that whole context switch thing. So, you know, if you could close some of those feedback loops, or at least tighten them, you know, to get them, you know, as fast as possible, and make your team work closer together. I mean, you can really find a lot of ways to, you know, reduce waste.
I think one of the coolest, like, surprise features that I ran into was just looking at the process tab, and I just added in a QA phase,
mm-hmm.
and then just saw immediately that showed up on the board, and everything was just beautifully scaled, and it looked like it had been built that way. Are there features that you think people might not see right away, but might stumble upon after using it for a bit?
One of the things that people, at least early on when we were still in beta, a lot of people didn't recognize that the details sections on both the projects and stories supports Markdown. So you can actually write, you know, more complex, almost like a wiki page, but not really that sophisticated or anything. But you can, you know, apply formatting and all kinds of stuff to it. So that, you know, that's intended to try to make it so you can, you know, build whatever you want to inside of those detail things. But no, I'm actually really interested to see things that don't jump out immediately, because then I have to improve. You might have seen hint panels at the bottom that try to explain, you know, what you can do on that page a little bit better.
Yeah.
So if there's something that doesn't jump out, like that's, you know, those are things that we definitely need to try to call out better. Because again, I really want to make it so you can just sit down and use it. You don't have to read a manual and you don't have to have instruction. You know, just sit down and, you know, and knock it out. But yeah, the process screen is really important in terms of, you know, a real Kanban sort of system, because everybody's value stream is completely different. So it really just depends on, you know, how your team works. And not only that, but it's going to change over time too. You're going to find different ways to work and, you know, different ways to become more efficient. And so you're going to want to be able to change your process. And so Zen embraces that idea very readily through things like, for example, if you create a phase and then you have stories in it, and then you realize, well, I don't want that phase anymore, and you go to delete the phase, you actually can move the tasks to another phase immediately, and it'll work just like, you know, you never had that phase before. So just little things like that tries to, again, embrace the idea of continuous improvement and say, okay, well, we know we're not going to get it right today necessarily, you know, but tomorrow we're going to be at least better than yesterday. You know, that's That's the whole idea. That's actually the name of our company blog too, is Better Than Yesterday. So that's kind of that's my mantra that I've had for a while. So like, you know, both from a product perspective and from a, you know, personal perspective, every day I try to make it, you know, better. It doesn't have to be perfect. You know, I don't have to be perfect in terms of my skills. I just have to be a little bit better than I was yesterday. And if I keep doing that, you know, then eventually we'll, you know, find success, I guess.
I didn't know if it would make sense. I noticed today as I was going through, I saw the coupon code thing, and I didn't know if you'd want to now or at any time want to do like any kind of, you know, promo, give out a coupon code or something.
Oh, yeah. We actually already have a coupon code that, so like if you guys want to put it, you know, on the post along with the podcast, it's just Kaizen. That. And it's okay. 50% off your first month.
Oh, nice.
It only lasts though until the end of July. So just, you know, next few days. Of course, I guess we don't actually have an expiration set on it, but that's what we're telling people. It only lasts until the end of July. So
I think we're running out of time here. So let me just close with two quick questions. One is any advice for the people out there who want to do what you're doing, you know, want to do the little solo startup thing, any words of wisdom for us?
Oh, words of wisdom. I don't know. That's, that's tough, but no, I'd say, first and foremost, it's cool to have a hobby. You know, it's cool to do software, you know, both professionally and like, you know, for fun. That's absolutely fantastic. And I have a lot of respect for everybody that does that too. You know, I'm that way. But if you decide you're going to launch something as a company, you have to think about things in a very different way. You have to think about it. You're not going to sit down and learn a new technology. You're going to sit down, you're going to write code, and you're going to develop it to be as, you know, do it as fast as possible, essentially, you know, obviously not foregoing quality and stuff like that. But it's easy to forget that too when you're doing something more as a hobby. You know, and also I think there's some trouble I think people run into because of the way internet startups typically work. I mean, most internet startups launch without, you know, any kind of revenue model. And they just kind of say, okay, well, we're going to get a bunch of page views and, you know, somehow we're going to translate a million uniques a month into money, right? Whether it's ads or whatever. And you can get away with that if you've got a couple million dollars of venture capital, but you know, if you're bootstrapping, you know, and meaning you're self-funding or you're, you know, working on your free time and your weekends and, you know, that kind of stuff, you need to be able to sell the product, you know, either that or it's not a real product, you know, it's just a hobby, and that's fine. Again, there's nothing wrong with that, you know, but I guess my point is to try to understand, you know, the class of what you're doing. You know, and neither is right or wrong, but, you know, embrace whatever it is that you're doing, whether it's, you know, productized or whether it's just, you know, a hobby. And if it's a hobby, I would very much encourage people to open source it then too, so everybody can get, you know, the full, you know, perspective on, you know, what you've done and why you've done it and, you know, that kind of stuff. Zen uses open source extensively. And one of the things that we're working on right now is an offering that's going to provide free accounts to open source projects. We haven't formalized it yet. We're still kind of coming up with what exactly it'll look like, you know, because of obviously my work with Ninject, I've always been big into open source and that sort of thing. And again, Zen relies on it extensively. So it's, you know, if we can give back to the community, then that's great.
And then finally, anything you want to tell us about up and coming interesting features or capabilities, either of Zen or of Ninject, your two big projects?
Sure. Well, in terms of Ninject, Ninject 2 is coming out again, you know, whenever I can get the time to actually wrap it up. And I have a nice website redesign and all kinds of stuff that's ready to go. That's a fun project too, because I can just, you know, the website's just a bunch of ninjas and, you know, that kind of stuff. But, in terms of Zen, you know, we're really trying to roll out new features literally like every few days. You know, our goal is to get to market as fast as possible and then, you know, use our customer feedback to try to drive the product. So, you know, we're we're listening to, you know, there's actually a feedback button right in the application that people can click and just talk, you know, and they say whatever they want. We've gotten, you know, at this point, we've probably gotten thousands, I guess, of messages from people. And it's interesting too, because we'll read them and then we'll throw them away. But the important stuff continues to come up, you know, and obviously I'm not talking about support questions and things like that. I just mean feedback. It's, you know, feature requests sort of thing. The really useful features will, you know, continue to appear multiple times. So, you know, the useful features, you know, 12 different people will ask for, like, for example, we launched without the ability to delete stories. And so, that was one of the most confusing things that people, you know, didn't understand about the product and wanted. And so we added it. You know, it was just everybody asked for it. So we're like, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. So we'll put it in there. But our goal is, we really embraced the 37 signals model of, you know, the whole getting real thing and try to, you know, keep our core product as simple as possible. So any feature that goes into it, has to go through a lot of, vetting, you know, before you can actually say, okay, this is quality enough that it's not going to degrade the user experience overall. You know, it's going to keep our base case is going to remain simple, but it's going to add good value for the people that want to use it. So really the same approach that I used in Inject too, which was I wanted somebody to be able to sit down and understand dependency injection. And so the simplest possible tool was the goal. Again, same thing kind of happened with that is, you know, I focused on trying to keep the base case as simple as possible, but then there's all kinds of, you know, additional more advanced features that you can get into. So for an Inject, it's things like contextual binding and that sort of stuff. With Xen, it's things like, you know, whip limits and, you know, the more lean features that you can work with. But for both products, really, my goal is to try to evolve them, you know, organically and let them, you know, grow. I think I've used the metaphor of a bonsai tree before. About software. So like some of the best software is just grown, you know, and it's tended rather than built. I think it's a lot more natural to use a, you know, a natural metaphor thinking about software rather than, you know, it's not a bridge, you know, it's more like a tree that grows over time. And so some of the best software I think is like a bonsai tree that's very closely tended and kept, you know, very orderly. And so that's actually why we have the bonsai tree on the Xen website, because it's really how I try to think about software, you know, just trying to almost attain, you know, this, again, no pun intended, Xen-like state of maintenance on it, you know, and every so, you know, gradually just grow it and keep it under control. That was a long rant. I don't even remember what the question was. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. I think that's a good way to take us out.
So I think the question was, how you feeling?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Nate, for coming on the show and talking to us. I know it's late where you are, so we'll let you go.
Sure. No, thanks for having me. It's been a good talk.
Yeah. Okay. Well, join us next time for Herding Code. Thanks a lot. Cool.
Wow.
Really, I think my favorite part of Xen is the, you know, there's the Xen image and then there's the bonsai tree and then it says, you know, reduce waste, take control of your process and crush the competition.
we've actually gotten flack about that too. People were complaining there. They were saying, I think you should go learn about Xen before you use it to, and, you know, it's like, well, yeah, it's kind of a joke. Honestly, when I put that on there, I didn't think about it. Like I didn't, you know, and now I left it on there because I'm like, oh, that's pretty ironic. That's great. I'm going to leave it there. But, you know, I guess people, like, you know, think that Xen is like this, you know, Xen really just means good, I think, in Japanese. And the name Xen really comes from Kaizen, you know, rather than anything else. It's not really anything about Buddhism. But anyways.
Hey, can you put YouTube videos in your cards?
You probably can, actually. I haven't tried it, but I bet you could put it at least in the details section. So you can tell.
By God, I'm going to try that.
Yeah, HTML encodes anything that shows up on the tag, or on the, I'm sorry, on the card itself. But you could put, at least I think it does. But you could put stuff into the details section.
Now we have to try it.
Yeah.
I don't know if Markdown supports that, right? That's you're limited to whatever.
No, you should be able to mix HTML in there.
Oh, okay.
I think. In theory.
I guess we won't know until we hear the Rickroll playing.